Let's recite Om three times. Take a deep inhalation. So open the eyes softly now. And we'll do the invocation to sage Patanjali. So you can either close the eyes and listen in, or you can read along on the screen and then chant along with me if you know this chant. So it has a little tune to it. So let's do that. Inhale. Yogen chittasya paden vacham malam sharirasya ch vaidyaken yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. And one of you, maybe Shanti, you are kind of new to this. Can you read the meaning in English?
I humbly bow down with folded hands and offer my salutations to Sage Patanjali, the highest among the munis who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through his treatise on Ayurveda of language, through his treatise on grammar, Patanjala Mahabhashya, and the impurities of the chitta, mind field, through his treatise on yoga sutras of Patanjali.
Wonderful. Thank you. Okay, so let me make sure I'm recording this. Okay. Let me hold on a second. Where's my mute button? I don't see my mute button.
Hover along the bottom of the screen. You might see icons.
I used to see it, but now that my... Oh! I'm sharing the screen.
Oh, yeah.
So...
Oh, maybe unshare and then...
I know, that I can do, I think, but I was wondering if there should be a way to...
Yeah, I think if you hover around, you'll see a mute button come up.
Oh, I see it. Now I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I see. Okay. Anyway, all right, so namaste and welcome everybody. This is our monthly session on the Yoga Sutras, understanding the concepts of yoga. And as we always do, you know, we go through a brief round of introductions. Just tell us your name, full name, where you are located, and... why did you decide to join this session? All right. So let's start. Any sequence? Eleanor, you want to start?
Okay. My name is Eleanor Lee. I'm retired from IT. I live here in Cary. I'm here today just to learn more about yoga philosophies to possibly help with everything that's going on right now with all the messages we're getting left and right. It would be good to be able to calm yourself down. So that's it.
Very good. Thank you, Eleanor. Laura? You have to unmute. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Laura Capoletti. I live in Cary, and I've been studying yoga for several years, and I always just like to learn as much as I can about the Yoga Sutras. Nice to be here with everyone today.
Welcome. Welcome, Laura. And Shanti.
Hi, I'm Shanti. I'm from Singapore. I've been practicing yoga for last 8 years. I started studying the Yoga Sutras with the teachers here, but I had to break. So I wanted to continue. And I want to understand why we do the things we do in the yoga classes.
It's great to have you, Shanti. Remember, everyone, it's Singapore and it's 2:30 a.m. there, and she decided to join us. It's amazing. Okay, thank you, Shanti. And Linda, next.
Okay. So, can you guys see me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I'm not seeing myself.
But that's, you know, the whole purpose of this Yoga Sutra is to see yourself eventually.
You know, very profound. And maybe that's why I need to be here. Well, I live in Cary, and I've been practicing with Sabat for about 2 years. And prior to that, I've done a lot of yoga, but I've never really explored the sutras before. And I am enjoying so much learning about the depth of yoga philosophy.
Very good, Linda. Welcome, Saurabh.
Hello, namaste, everyone. My name is Saurabh, and I live in Cary, North Carolina. Subhasji, this is my second class with you. First, I started with you probably 6 months ago, 21 days, more like Hatha Yoga. And then during that, you also spoke about briefly on Patanjali, which kind of attracted me towards it. And you recommended a book, the Yoga Sutra Patanjali's. I bought it, and then I'm reading it slowly. And then I'm also doing this 14 days intensive meditation with you, which is ending tomorrow. And I'm reading this book, but still, you know, I think I need a teacher who can explain things a little bit more deeper. And I'm so glad that I found you, Subhasji. I really want to learn from you and understand a little bit better this Yoga Sutra so that I can use in my day-to-day life.
Thank you.
That's the reason I'm here.
Very good, Saurabh. Thank you. Yusuf?
Namaste, everyone. Namaste. This is Yusuf Natchaswala, and I live in Apex. I'm taking the 14-day meditation intensive right now. And incidentally, the Patanjali, you know, the sutras, it was something that I have known before, actually, because many years back, I think I was maybe 5-7 years old, something, my mom had taken a class on Patanjali philosophy and yoga philosophy.
Wow.
In a place called Kaivalya Dham in Mumbai. But over the years, I had forgotten all these things, you know. And I've recently started taking interest in meditation to deal with stress and anxiety. And so when you started talking about that, you know, I kind of, again, rekindled that interest or that what I had from before. And so this is perfect, you know, to start learning about these sutras because I have kind of heard them from my mom before. And so I'm interested now to learn more about it.
Very good. Very good. Thank you, Yusuf. Welcome. Krish.
Yeah, Yeah, this is Krish. Sorry you guys can't see me. I got a old laptop. It's my old son's laptop. I don't think it has a camera, so I need to change it for next class. I live in Morrisville and pretty close to Subhashji's house. So yeah, I've been to yoga a little bit before, but this is the first time I'm just trying to learn about the Yoga Sutras. I've never been to these classes, so just want to explore what is and learn more about yoga.
Thank you, Krish. Welcome. Okay. So welcome, everyone. And, you know, we've been doing this for a while now, this Yoga Sutra studies. And, you know, we do one round, and usually that round lasts, I would say, a year and a half to 2 years. That's what my experience has been. And right now we are coming close to the end of this this cycle. So this will be the last few sutras, I believe. the whole idea here is to understand the concepts given to us by Patanjali. And, you know, what the one thing that I always like to emphasize is that even though, you know, generally people consider this as a form of philosophy, but to me, much more than philosophy, it's learning how to live our life. You know, it's learning how to lead our day-to-day life, how to get rid of some of the pains and suffering that we have in our life, or discomforts in our life, and then just go on a path which is much more meaningful, more pleasurable and joyful and all that stuff. So that's what it is all about. It's about life more than just dry philosophy. It's very, very practical. So you can think of it as a philosophy, psychology, methodology, you know, all that combined into one. Procedures, all right? So we have been kind of dividing these concepts into groups, and I've done a few groups before. So the first group was from chapter 1, where we talked about the definition of yoga, where we understood what yoga is, where Patanjali defines yoga as the ability to calm the mind, which says yoga chitta vritti nirodhaha. Okay, that's the definition he provided in chapter 1, which means yoga is defined as the ability to do a nirodha. Nirodha means cessation or diminishing of the vrittis. Vrittis are the changes, that constant set of fluctuations, you know, the constant chatter that goes on in the mind. Okay, so that's the vrittis. So he says yoga by definition is the ability to do a cessation of the vrittis of the chitta. Chitta is the overall complex of the mind. Okay, and we talked about this whole mind complex, as it's called, which is a combination of mind, intellect, ego, and the memories. So there are the four components of that chitta. From another, you know, context, in the Vedanta context, they call it the antahkarana. Antahkarana, that's the name given to that combination of those four, which constitutes our mind, the whole mind complex, as it's called. Okay, so that's the whole idea of yoga, is to calm the mind eventually. And in chapter 1, you know, that initials block of sutras, we talked about this whole concept of the vrittis, which are the ways we produce these fluctuations in the mind, and we had defined five vrittis. And then eventually in that same block we also talked about the concept of abhyasa and vairagya, which is how to establish a practice of your own, a very ongoing, uninterrupted, very devoted kind of practice, and how that helps, and how we can apply this concept of vairagya, which is total non-attachment, complete non-attachment to everything that can be perceived by us. Okay, so that was the first block, and then we had switched to the second block, which was understanding the eight limbs of yoga, And if you recall, the eight limbs of yoga are the yamas, niyamas, asana, pranayama, etc., all the way to final stages of meditation called samadhi. So we spent a lot of time understanding those eight limbs of yoga. Okay? And then we had diverted back to some concept of the Ishvara, which is God, and we spent some time on that. And then finally, we went to this chapter 2 now, from the beginning. I mean, we did the eight limbs of yoga, which is the end part of chapter 2. Now we started at the beginning of chapter 2, which essentially talks about few of concepts which are very, very important. Okay, the concepts talked about in chapter 2 are, the first thing that was talked about is this whole concept of Kriya Yoga, which is a combination of three practices. Okay, tapas, swadhyaya, and Ishvara pranidhana. Tapas is austerity, swadhyaya is trying to understand the scriptures and try to understand yourself. And Ishvara pranidhana is total dedication and surrender to Ishvara or God. Okay, so those are the three concepts presented to us in chapter 2. Patanjali calls it Kriya Yoga. And then it goes into the whole discussion on klesha. Klesha, you can loosely translate that as suffering. Okay? Affliction, suffering, pain, even you can, these in modern terminology, you can call it stress. Okay? So what is stress? What causes stress and all that? So that was the next topic that we talked about. And there are five of those in terms of, you know, the context of those kleshas. So the five were avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, abhinivesha. What are these? These are avidya is ignorance, asmita is egoism or the ego sense, raga and dvesha are strong likes and dislikes, and abhinivesha is the sense of fear of death or a desire to stay clinging to this life. Okay? Those were the kleshas. And from there, Patanjali moves on to a discussion of this whole concept of reincarnation, so to say, rebirth. So he says very strongly that we go through this whole sequence of cycles of birth, death, rebirth, etc. Okay, that's a very strong component of this discussion. And then he talks about, you know, what causes this suffering, what causes all the afflictions, and he boils down to the fact that it's all caused by this ignorance, okay? And this ignorance of not knowing who I am, what my true identity is, that is ultimately the root cause of all the suffering that we go through. Okay, so that's what basically we have been discussing in the last few sessions. The main theme of these sessions is the understanding of this concept of the philosophy called Sankhya. Okay, is everyone familiar with Sankhya? I mean, have you heard the term at all? Those new folks, Yusuf, have you heard the term Sankhya?
No, Subhaji.
Okay, so I'm assuming Saurabh and Krish. Saurabh, have you heard the term Sankhya?
No, this is the first time.
All right, you know, I need to spend a couple of minutes on understanding, kind of going over that whole concept of Sankhya, because, you know, the philosophy of, or the concepts of yoga that Patanjali has presented to us, he has used the underlying concepts from Sankhya to build kind of, he has used that as the base for his philosophy, and then he has built a structure of the Yoga Sutras on top of that base, okay, Sankhya. So if I were just to go back and give you an overall broad picture, then let me write these things down, because you may not, oh, maybe I have a slide here, hold on a second, I thought I do. No? I thought I did have a slide. Okay, anyway. Kundan Mi. Doesn't matter. Okay. So the whole idea is to, you know, I'm just going to go back and quickly tell you that there are six systems of Indian philosophy, six systems, okay? And they are called Nyaya, and let me write them down, otherwise you will not know what I'm talking about. Hold on a second. Okay. All right. Okay, so can you see that screen now?
Yes.
Okay, so there are six systems of Indian philosophy. Okay. Six systems of Indian philosophy. And they are Nyaya, and there is Vaisheshika, okay, and there is Sankhya, Yoga, there is Mimamsa, and Vedanta. Now, I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but this is just to give you a kind of a overall perspective of where we fit into this whole scheme of philosophies in Indian, in the Indian context. Okay, so these kind of go in pairs. Nyaya and Vaisheshika are studied together, Sankhya and Yoga are studied together, and then Mimamsa and Vedanta, sometimes, you know, they are studied together. But now, of course, most people study Vedanta independently and Mimamsa independently. Anyway, so the main theme within the Sankhya philosophy is that there are two entities, two independent real entities, and the names given to those entities are, so the two entities are Purusha and Prakriti, okay? So Purusha is, you can loosely translate that as the soul or the Atman, as they call it, Atma or Atman, self, that's another word. Some, you know, some of these terms come to mind. And then Prakriti is this entire material complex that we are all a part of, right? So that's the whole material thing, which is, you know, my body, mind, intellect, everything, and this entire visible universe that we see around us, that's all a part of Prakriti. So what this says is that this pure Purusha is pure consciousness. It's nothing but just consciousness. Whereas this complex, which is the Prakriti, is non-conscious. It has no consciousness. It's non-conscious, you can say. Okay? So those are the two entities which are extremely important for us to understand. Because when we go back to the sutra number 2 in the first chapter itself, which defines yoga, which is yoga chitta vritti nirodhaha, which says yoga is to sustain, suppress or minimize the vrittis or the fluctuations in the mind. When that happens, that the next sutra is very important. When that happens, it says tada drashtuhu swarupe avasthanam, which means that when the mind has been completely stilled, when the all the chatter in the mind has been stilled, made to stop, basically, then only you can realize your own true nature. And that true nature is nothing but this pure consciousness. Okay? So that's what we're trying to attain, is to recognize that my identity is not this body. My identity is not this mind or this intellect or my thoughts or my feelings or emotions. I those are things that happen to me based on my life experiences. But I am in reality apart from all that in the form of this Purusha or the Self or the Atman or the pure consciousness. So that's the main concept in the whole yoga thought. Okay? And that's what we have been discussing in the last few sessions. What are the characteristics of Purusha? What are the characteristics of Prakriti and all that? So let me go back to that.
Subhashji, can I ask a question?
Sure, absolutely.
So this is what you just explained, the Sankhya philosophy. So is it the same thing you were showing the slides during the meditation course, you know, with the intellect, ego, that kind of...
Those slides I showed are basically based on the stuff that is presented by Patanjali, but they are all based on the same concepts which have their origin in the Sankhya philosophy. Yes.
Okay, because there also I think you talked about Purusha, I think, and Prakriti, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
I had that dotted line, and on one side of that was Purusha, I believe, or no, maybe I'm mistaken.
No, you're absolutely right, yeah. In fact, I have that slide. Let me just show you that slide. I just pulled it up. Okay, so this is the slide that you're talking about.
Right.
Okay, so in this one, so these are the four components of our mind complex. Okay, mind. So ego is one, memory is one, mind, which is the cognitive mind, and the intellect. All right, so these are the four major components of this mind complex. And this, the mind is the one which receives input from the five senses. Okay, so the sense of smell, touch, taste, etc., these are the five senses which give it the input. And then there are the five organs of action, which are the outgoing arrow. So there are five organs of action. Okay, but that's the mind. And then the intellect, memory, and the ego. Like we said, the ego is the one which is causing all the problems for us. Okay, because it likes to pull stuff from the memory and work only on those elements which it likes or dislikes. It does not want to do anything to have to anything to do with the pure memory. All right. But when we go and go past this dotted line, that's where you can say this is the soul or the Purusha or the drashta, seer. Okay, so that's kind of a very rough picture which tells us how, you know, we want to look at ourselves. Okay, even though our true identity is here, but we are always bound or tied to this whole complex because of ignorance. All right, so that's where we are. Let me go back to now the sutra that we did in the last couple of sessions, last session maybe. That way we can catch up with what we are doing here. Okay, so let me start with this. You know, we covered all this last time, but so I'm not going to spend time, but very quickly go through this whole sequence. So the first thing we learned was that this suffering that we call our, you know, that pain that we have in our life, the suffering, all the, you know, the constant change that goes on, is caused by this misidentification of the Purusha and Prakriti. That means, in our ignorance, we believe that Purusha and Prakriti are kind of merged together, and the intellect is not independent. It is influenced by the ego, because ego kind of takes over, and you know, the whole thing is a mess basically. Okay, it's the Sanyoga, which Sanyoga means union. Okay, so here, what it's saying is it's the union or the apparent union between the Purusha and the Prakriti, which is the cause of this suffering. All right? So that's the statement here. The cause of that avoidable pain is the union of the seer and the seen. Seer is the Purusha and the seen is the Prakriti. Okay? So that was the sutra number 17. And then 18 was a definition, kind of an understanding of what this whole concept of Prakriti is. Okay? So there, the most important concept that we need to understand is that of the three gunas. Does everyone know what the three gunas are? Have you heard them, the terms before? The three gunas.
Yeah.
Who has never heard the term three gunas? Yusuf, are you familiar with the three gunas?
I'm familiar.
Three gunas, okay. Saurabh?
Yes, I'm familiar with this.
So can you list the three gunas, name them?
Sattva, Rajas and Tamas.
Yes, okay, very good. Sattva, Rajas and Tamas. Very nice. So these are the three gunas which control our life basically because they are constantly changing. They are constantly interacting with each other. At one moment, one guna is dominant. At the very next moment, another guna may be dominant. So when we are dominated by sattva, we might be doing something nice, peaceful, calm, intellectual, you know, reasonable stuff. When we are influenced by rajas mostly, then we are doing stuff that involves action, movement, ambition, you know, gung-ho, type A personality, as they call it, that's rajas. And when we are influenced by tamas, then of course we're influenced by sleep, dullness, negativity, suffering, etc., etc., all the negative stuff, right? Ignorance is caused by the tamas guna. So that is the nature of this prakriti. That's exactly what it is saying here, that this scene or this prakriti is of the nature of the three gunas. Illumination, the words used by Patanjali are illumination, which represents sattva, activity, which represents rajas, and inertia, which represents tamas. And then it also consists of these elements and the sense organs, right? What are the elements we're talking about? Anybody remember the five elements or five elements?
Like the five senses or?
Elements, no, the Mahabhuta, elements.
Earth, fire.
Yes.
Wind or air.
Ether.
Yes. So it's earth, water, fire, air, and ether. Five of them. Earth, water, fire, air, and ether. So those are the five elements. They are called, in Sanskrit, they call them Pancha Mahabhuta. Panch means five. Maha means great. And Bhuta is the elements. Okay. So they are...
Subhashji, what is ether means?
Ether is space. Akash. Just this vast expanse of space that we see around us, that's ether.
Okay.
Space. In Sanskrit, they call it Akash. Akash also means the sky, but Akash also means a vast space.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So this is the nature of this prakriti, because everything is a composite of these five elements, whether it's human body or even elements outside us, you know. Whether it's trees or stone or anything that you can see, it's all a combination of these five elements. And of course, there are sense organs for a human being. There are all these senses. Somebody mentioned sense of smell, touch, taste, etc. Okay, so they are all a part of this prakriti. All right. So we talked about this chart. I don't know if I have that chart here. Right here. So let me go back. So this is the structure of the prakriti, all right? And then there are these, categories of elements, tattvas. They are called tattvas, elements, categories, okay? And that is best understood by this picture that I showed last time. Okay, so this picture, I don't know if you can see it well, but this is how they talk about the evolution of Prakriti. So there's on the left side there's Purusha or the consciousness, but there is this original Prakriti. When we say original or the Mula Prakriti, which means at that time the three gunas, the sattva, rajas and tamas, are in a state of perfect balance. Okay? And that time when they are in perfect balance, then this nothing can happen basically. No evolution can take place. Evolution takes place because somehow, and they don't tell you how that happened, okay? Sankhya philosophy doesn't say how that happened, but they said somehow one of the gunas took over, which was the rajas, because rajas, you need rajas for creation, for activity. Okay? Somehow that took over, and then it started this whole sequence of creation. And that sequence is given by these arrows. The first thing that got created is the buddhi, or the intellect, okay? Intellect or the discrimination. And then the second is this ahankara, which is the ego, all right? Self-identity. And then there are two branches here. One goes to the mind, and then the five elements, five active instruments and five cognitive senses. And then these are the other branch goes to the five subtle elements and the five gross elements. Okay? So in effect, then we are talking about these 25 elements, okay? So these are 20 here, 5 plus 5 plus 5 plus 5, 20. And then ahankara, no, the mind, that's 21, mind, ahankara 22, buddhi 23, and then this mula prakriti 24, and purusha 25. The title is 23 evolutes, okay? These 23 are the ones that get as evolution happens. All right? So that's what we talk.
What are the subtle elements again?
The subtle elements are the, they are called the tanmatra, which is the sense of smell, touch, taste, and all that.
Of course.
They are subtle because, they're subtle because the gross counterpart of these subtle is these cognitive senses, the sense of, they're the ear, nose, skin, tongue, etc., right? Eyes. So those are the more grosser parts of this concept. So nose... So the nose is the cognitive element, which is a gross element, that represents the sense of smell, which is a subtle element. Because the sense of smell has to be understood in the mind. It doesn't have, you cannot just, the nose is not doing anything, any sensing. It's an instrument.
Right, I see.
Okay, so the instrument, which is the nose, it brings all the atoms or whatever molecules from outside, and then whatever is the sense perception from there, it is sending it to the mind, and that's where all this cognition happens.
Okay.
As a part of this five, so that's where these five sense elements are there, subtle elements.
Okay, I understand now.
Very good.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so this is how this whole evolution took place, as they say. And then at the very, it all goes from subtle to gross to grosser to the grossest. And at the very gross, the most gross of all these 23 elements is the earth element, which represents the sense of smell. Okay, so they say earth is the grossest, and then it goes into the slightly subtler elements and all that. All right? So this is where we talked about the groupings. So where did I have? All right. So there are you know, then they talked about these vishesha and avishesha, etc. So we understood these terms last time. The word vishesha implies, so let me go back here. The concept here is that there is constantly a cause and effect going on, constantly. Okay, so in this one, we said the first thing that happened was to create a little bit of a disturbance in the balance that existed in the Prakriti first. And that, to have that disturbance, you need the Purusha to be present next to the Prakriti. So they have to be in close proximity with each other. That's the only time things can happen. Okay, so they are separate and yet close enough that they can influence each other. Purusha can influence Prakriti. Okay? So that's the first cause, that the presence of Purusha and Prakriti that caused the disturbance. And what that started is this cycle of evolution. And then Prakriti became the cause of intellect. Intellect is the result or the effect. But then it becomes the cause of Ahankara or the ego. Same thing. Ego is an effect, at the same time becomes the cause of this creation on the right side, on the left side here, on the chart. It also is the cause for this five subtle elements. All right? So now, but the five subtle elements, they become the cause of these five gross elements. So this is how they kind of define these this whole progression. So those which have no further effect. So these things have no further effect. The mind, five cognitive senses, etc. They cannot produce any more effect. So they are the ultimate effect. Therefore, they are called vishesha. That's the Sanskrit term for those which cannot produce any further effect. Okay. So this is the five gross elements: earth, water, fire, air, and ether. Five sense organs: ears, skin, eyes, nose, and tongue. Five organs of action: hands, legs, speech, excretion, and procreation. And then finally, the mind. All right? So these are 16. They are called vishesha, which means they have no further effect. But they are caused by, you know, some other elements. Okay? And then there are these six avishesha, which means avisheshas are those which are both cause and effect. We knew that ahankara, ego, is an effect as well as a cause. Same is the five tanmatras, sense of smell, taste, form, touch, and sound. All right? Now, what the term buddhi or the intellect is only a lingamatra, even though it is an effect and a cause, but it's pointing to something. It's pointing to the pure prakriti or the mula prakriti or the root prakriti. Okay, so that's why it's called lingamatra or a mark or a pointer only. And then this prakriti, which we said is the total unmanifest prakriti without a mark or without a pointer whatsoever, or it has no cause anywhere. Alright? So now, you know, those of you who are joining today for the first time, all I have to tell you is that you're joining on a day when we are studying something which is absolutely the most difficult part of Yoga Sutra. So, if you are confused, if you are feeling sleepy, I have my full sympathy. I understand that thoroughly. Because this is one of the most challenging parts of Yoga Sutras to understand. Sankhya philosophy. That's why, we spent a fair amount of time in the last few sessions to just go over these concepts. Okay? So, like I said, if you are confused, very thoroughly understandable.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
The chart?
Yes.
It looks to me like that the cognitive senses should be an effect of the subtle elements. Right? They're related. I mean, the sense organs and the sense of smell. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Well, again, you know, this is how they explain in the text, in the Sankhya text. This is all from the Sankhya text. So what they are saying is, you know, these gross elements are at the very grossest level. They cannot have any more effects. And each of these subtle elements, for example, the element of smell, okay, that's what causes, for example, the nose element. The sense of the hearing, that made ears to appear. Things like that. That's how they are saying. So there's a sense of, you know, these are the sense perceptions within the mind. They are all mixed up, okay? There's no individual component here. It's all mixed up, right? The same mind which is making sense of all these five senses. But then you need individual sense organs to represent all these five. So that's how this evolution is presented in the Sankhya philosophy.
Okay.
They don't explain anything. This is all, you know, you have to understand it just the way you want to. You know, it's your interpretation, basically. In the text itself, all they say, this is exactly what happened. That's it. It's like Patanjali. He gives you no explanation, no ideas why he's saying what he's saying. So we have to look for some of these commentators to help us make sense of all this. Okay?
Yeah, I think Subhaji Saurav here. So the way I was understanding this one, again, I'm first time, okay? So I think you mentioned that the cognitive senses, like, you know, touching and seeing and smelling, those are basically a, kind of a tool in the body, right?
Uh-huh.
And the right-hand side, the subtle elements, those are more like, you know, how do you process those things, right? Like you have nose and ear and touch and everything. But how do you process everything? Those are like subtle things, right?
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
Maybe that thing is the right side, the subtle elements, it talks about that.
Yeah.
And the left side, the cognitive senses, those are like the physical kind of a nose, ear, eyes, skin, those kind of things.
Yeah, you can look at it that way. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is where we went up to last time, okay? All right. So if it's okay, we'll move on to the next sutra, which is number 20. All right, and what we have been doing is to actually go through each of the Sanskrit words here and then see if we can understand each word separately first and then try to make sense of the whole sentence. All right, so that's the way we have been doing in the past. So I'm going to read the Sanskrit first. It says, drashta drishi matraha shuddhopi pratyaya anupashyah. Okay, so drashta drishi matraha shuddhopi pratyaya anupashyah. Okay, now let's go through the individual words first, what that means. Drashta. Drashta means a seer, one who observes, one who is watching. Okay, that's drashta. And Patanjali likes to use this word for most of you cannot read the Sanskrit word, so this is the English transliteration. Patanjali likes to use this word for the Purusha. Okay, he likes to use the word drashta or the seer for Purusha, because all the Purusha is doing is to be an observer in this whole complex of the prakriti of the mind, body, intellect complex. Okay? That's drashta. Then drishi matra. Drishi is to see something, is the ability to see something. It's the sense of seeing, so to say. So when you add the word matra, it means drishi matra means just the sense of seeing or the power of seeing. Okay? So that's the power of seeing. Shuddho. Shuddho means pure. It's clean, uncluttered, absolutely without any blemishes. That's shuddho. That means shuddho means it has no suffering, no kind of likes and dislikes, none of that. It's pure, clean, uncluttered. That's shuddhopi. Then pratyaya is the content of the mind. We've talked about that earlier. Okay? So the whole thing, what it means is that this drashta, which is the seer or the observer or the purusha or the soul, it's just the power of seeing, drishi matraha, just the power of seeing. And it's pure. Okay, it's very, very pure, uncluttered, messed up, not messed up by anybody. Even though it is so clean and pure and only the power of seeing, but because it is connected with the ego or the intellect, and then it is trying to understand what the content of the mind is, it seems to see through the mind. It seems to see through the intellect. And that's where it gets bound by the intellect. That's where we immediately, because we are not aware of the reality, and we get confused, and because even though it is pure, we get tangled up. We get entangled in this whole complex of mind-body. So that's the whole concept here. This seer is nothing but the power of seeing. It's although pure, it appears to see through the elements of the mind. Okay? So drashta drishi matraha shuddhopi pratyaya anupashya. Anupashya means to again to see, and anupashya is to follow. Anu means behind. So it's following behind what's contained in the mind and trying to understand what's in the mind. Okay? So this is where we are, after discussing the scene or the prakriti. So in the previous couple of sutras, Patanjali talked about the prakriti, and now he turns to the purusha or the drashta or the seer. And again, I'm repeating here that drashta is the power of seeing only, or the pure consciousness, but he happens to observe the content of the mind through the intellect or through the buddhi. All right, but even though, like we said, prakriti or the buddhi, etc., they are all influenced by the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. Purusha is pure; it's never touched by the three gunas. All right, so that's the statement here that we make. So these commentators now, they kind of give their own views as to how to distinguish between these two. So they say purusha is very different from buddhi. So just to understand the distinction as to why they are two separate entities. So buddhi always mutates. We know that, right? Intellect always mutates depending on what is presented to it. If it sees a tree, it's going to think about a tree. If it sees some food, it's going to think about some food. Okay? It's mutated constantly. All right? Depending on what's presented to the mind through the five senses or through memory. We can always have content in the mind through either memory or through the five senses. Okay? And therefore, it's always mutated. Now, buddhi is also, what we have seen in the past, in the previous sutra number 15 or so, I think 18, it was 18 or so. We have seen that the purpose of buddhi is to serve the needs of purusha. Okay? It's like a servant. It's like a subservient role to purusha, the buddhi, because it's trying to do something for the sake of purusha. And if I take you back to number, I think it was 18, let me see. Okay, that's what it was. So what it says is that this whole concept of prakriti is the nature of, let me read this again, the scene or the prakriti is the nature of the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, and consists of the elements and sense organs. And the most important part here was that the purpose of prakriti is to provide both experiences and liberation. The word used by in Patanjali in Sanskrit are bhoga and apavarga. Bhoga and apavarga. Bhoga means to present experience of life. Apavarga means liberation. Okay, so that's what we did in the last sutra. Okay, so this is what it is now. What it says is that buddhi actually representing prakriti is for the sake of purusha. But purusha is for himself. He is not doing anything for anybody. He's just sitting there, basically. Buddhi is inert. We mentioned that buddhi or the intellect has no consciousness of its own. It's working, it's functioning entirely based on the consciousness borrowed or reflected from the purusha. That's very important to remember. Purusha is the only conscious element. Okay? This entire complex of prakriti, mind, body, intellect, anything that we see around us, it's all inert, it's all non-conscious. How does it all function? Because of the proximity of Purusha in this prakriti, Purusha has this consciousness. You can think of it as a light, which is reflected in the buddhi, and that's how the buddhi functions or the intellect functions. Okay. Now the buddhi is inert. It is composed of the three gunas. Purusha is completely unaffected by the three gunas. It is pure consciousness, but it is totally unaffected by the three gunas. It has absolutely nothing to do with the gunas. It's not a part of the Purusha. So even though quite different, there are some apparent similarities. Because of this ignorance now, you know, we start kind of thinking of them together, and then there is an apparent similarity that we perceive. It's because of ignorance. There is no similarity otherwise. But apparently because of ignorance, we start believing that this cognition is attributed to buddhi, and the content of mind then, because of this proximity and the reflection, etc., we start believing that the mind is also the content of the mind is attributed to Purusha by mistake, by ignorance. Okay, and that's for that's how the Purusha gets misidentified with all the changes, the fluctuations, etc., that are going on in the mind. But all that is happening because of the ego, but we attribute it to Purusha because of our ignorance. So that's exactly the whole purpose of yoga, is to understand this concept and eventually eliminate this ignorance. That's the entire thrust of this whole yoga sutra, is to understand this. Okay? Once we understand it at least at the intellectual level, then we can start working on it. Then, of course, there are techniques given on how to get rid of all this. But understanding is the key as to why we are doing what we are doing. All right? Okay, so this is what the statement was, that this drashta or the seer is pure, and yet it feels as if it is connected to the mind. It is influenced by the mind. Okay? And then the next statement again is, it's almost, I don't know, Patanjali has been very, very crisp and, very brief in his statement, but somehow it seems like this is a repetition of the same statement we saw earlier, because it says here, tadartha eva drishyasya atma. So tad here means that means the Purusha. So this drishya means the prakriti, which is the seen. So seer and the seen, what does the seer see? Prakriti, buddhi, or the elements of the mind. Mind, buddhi, intellect, ego and all that. Okay. So what he's saying is that this whole purpose, okay, the purpose of this prakriti is only to serve the purpose of the Purusha. And we saw that in the previous number 18 sutra, where it says bhoga and apavarga. Right? The experience of lifetime as well as liberation. So that's what it says here, that the seen exists only for the sake of the seer. Okay? So we already saw that in the Sutra 218, which is to provide experience. This is what we saw here, experience and liberation. Those two are the goals of this prakriti. All right? Okay, prakriti and buddhi, etc., they are inert and they need the consciousness of Purusha for all cognition. Okay, but the Purusha actually does not play any active role in cognition. The only thing that's happening is, you know, the mind and the intellect and the buddhi and all that, they are functioning, and they present it to the Purusha, who should be just the seer, but because of that close proximity they get confused with each other, and it becomes almost, it's apparent as if Purusha is engaged in all that. You know, one example that most commentators give is You can think of the moon and its reflection in a pool of water, for example, right? So the moon is shining on the sky, but when we look at the reflection, we see the moon in the reflection itself. So we think that's the moon. But then, if there is disturbance on the surface of the water, okay, you throw a stone, it starts moving. And what do we see? We see that the moon is also moving, right? This reflection also moves. Now, if we are not aware that there is an actual moon on the sky, and we only know that this is the moon in the water, you know, that's all we see, then we will believe that moon is moving. It's engaged with all the activities of the water. Okay? So that's how it is right now. There is this Purusha, which is standing apart, and is reflecting into the intellect or the mind and the ego. Okay? And that reflection is what is causing that mind and the ego to become conscious. And the buddhi is able to function because of that consciousness, right? But now, things happen in the mind, right? All this churn goes on, all this chatter goes on in the mind, all right? Then reflection starts moving because we are only seeing that reflection, just like the moon. Okay, and then we start identifying this whole movement with the Purusha. We identify it with the whole complex here. We believe that's what it is, that's it. So we see that reflection moving, and we believe that Purusha is engaged in this movement, and we don't recognize the distinction between the two, we suffer. Okay, that's an example that most commentators give in how to understand how this reflection concept is integrated into this whole mind, intellect function. Okay? So that's one example that they give.
So Subhashji, going by this same example that you talked about the moon's reflection, so is the process or the practice of yoga and meditation, is it somehow a way of calming or making the disturbances in that, if you take an analogy, right, like that, to calm those disturbances, mm-hmm. so that you can see what the actual reflection really is all about, rather than...
Right. That's exactly right. That's exactly the point.
Perceiving it.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yes, that's exactly right, and that's we're coming to that. But that's exactly the point, that we're trying to understand what is causing this disturbance in the mind. Okay, when we know the cause of this disturbance, then we can do something to eliminate that disturbance. Okay, and that's what is leading to that now, that discussion.
Okay, but so that means you can only see it through that as a reflection. So, like, if the moon were the Purusha, right? So you can't actually necessarily see the Purusha. It's only through the medium of that reflection that you can perceive it, if you are able to calm it.
Yes. That's very true. That's exactly true. If you're able to calm that whole thing, then you will see the distinction between the two, separation between the two, then you'll be able to see the real Purusha, or real moon. Okay? Otherwise, you are completely entangled in that whole... You're not able to see up toward the moon at all.
Okay.
Yes, Tabash, I was thinking of kind of a different example, something that's even more concrete. Say, for example, someone says to you, you look really good today, and then your prickhi goes into action and says... Does that mean I looked bad yesterday? And rather than, if you're using your Purusha, you would just hear the words as words, you know, you look good today. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
No.
No?
Well, you know, let me clarify here. You know, you use the word by using the Purusha, right? What does that mean when you said use the Purusha?
Well, you use your... it's like you use your... You don't attach anything to the words. except for goodness or...
Right, no, but when you say, I'm trying to pick on those words, use the Purusha you said. What does that mean?
I guess that is your soul is,
No, it's a very good, you have to extend your thinking. You have to extend your thinking beyond this.
Right.
So to understand what you said. You said use the Purusha. What I'm trying to tell you is,
if you use your Purusha, you're looking at something clearly. You're seeing the moon as the moon rather than seeing the reflection, right?
Again, I'm asking the question, what does it mean when you say use the Purusha? Use in what sense?
Well, that means you're using your consciousness, I guess. I don't really know what.
Okay, let me see if I can clarify this
what
doubt.
What word would be?
Let me see if I can clarify.
Okay.
What we are saying is, remember in that picture that we saw. Okay. Purusha here on the left, very separate. It is not engaged in anything. We cannot use it for anything. It's not a usable entity. The only thing that's usable is all these things on the right side here. The intellect, the ego, the mind, the memories and all that. That's all that is usable. That's all that we can use. Nothing else. Purusha is not something we can use. That's why...
But isn't one of the goals is to get more in touch with your consciousness, so you can?
No. That's in a sense that's true. But the way we get in touch with the consciousness is to recognize the separation between the two. That's the goal here. See, right now this Purusha, like we said, because of that reflection being viewed as the real thing, we are entangled. We are not recognizing the separateness between the Purusha and Prakriti. And that's what is causing all the problem. And so the goal is to recognize the separation. That's it, basically. But the action of whatever we are doing, whether it is perception, whether it is thinking, whether it is emotions, it's all happening in this right side, which is all this mind, body, intellect complex. Purusha has absolutely no role to play in that, in reality. But in apparent reality, it is playing a role because we are confused now. Okay? That's the whole goal here, to separate out the two entities eventually.
Also, I think a question that would be related to this goes back to Sutra 18, where it's talking about the liberation of the Purusha.
Uh-huh.
So maybe you could talk about what that is, and we would understand a little bit more about.
So the liberation, you see, the concept here was that the whole Prakriti, right? It's all a composite of these gunas and everything else, right? The Purusha is bound to Prakriti because of ignorance. Ignorance of what? Ignorance of not knowing my true identity. That's the number one. All right. What does that do? It makes me believe that I am the Purusha, or this ego begins to think that I am the controller, I am the ruler. All right. But the whole idea here is to start cleansing the mind. Okay, purifying the mind. Okay. Thinking happens because of what? What makes us think? What makes us what brings up all the thoughts, the emotions, the feelings in the mind? What is it that does that? What's the source of all that?
Memories.
Memories, right? Did somebody say memories?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's exactly the point, all right? It's the memories that are embedded in our subconscious levels that keep popping up in the mind. Any trigger, any trigger from outside or inside that happens, we pull stuff from the memory. And that is where all these likes and dislikes are embedded. They are hidden there as a part of the memory. The term Patanjali uses for these likes and dislikes are raga and dvesha. Okay, so like I mentioned, you know, when we have an experience, right, every experience gets a label. I like it, I dislike it. I love it, I hate it. I want it, I don't want it. Okay? Those are the things that get added every time we have an experience, no matter what. And that is what is causing all the thoughts. You see a flower. Immediately thoughts will come in because there is memory in the mind. Oh, I saw this flower last time, it was so beautiful, and I love this flower, I loved its smell, and love the way it looks. And then your mind goes into a churn. All because of the past impressions called, the word they use is samskara. Samskara, that's the word that you have to keep in mind. Samskara is the past impressions that we carry in our mind. And they are the ones which continuously cause our thoughts, emotions, you know. We get angry because of the samskara. We get jealous because of the samskara. Because some trigger comes and it pulls something stuff out from the memories and it makes us jealous. It makes us angry, makes us hateful, makes us love somebody. Things like that, right? So
let me ask you this.
Yes.
So, if you choose not to hate that person, are you using illumination?
Well, when you say, if you choose, who chooses it? See, we are always trying to understand.
I choose.
Who is I? Who is I? That's the point we have to understand. Who is I?
So, is I... That's myself, I guess.
Okay, so again, you know, we went to that whole chart, like there are four elements, right? Four components of this whole sequence.
I guess my intellect chooses.
Ah, right. That's what I was getting at.
What were you wanting me to say?
Yes, so who is the chooser? Is the ego or the intellect? That's the big question. Always that's the question. Who is choosing it?
Going back to my example where somebody says, you look good today, and I choose to think of it as, oh, thank you, then I'm using my intellect. Would you say that makes sense?
It makes, okay, there are two things going on here. Somebody says you're looking good, right? If it makes you feel a sense of arrogance and pride, I did something, I'm looking good. So that's ego.
But what if I just accept it as, thank you.
That's intellect.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, as long as we have no side effects of that, no attachment to what the person said.
There's no attachment. Okay. I'm beginning to see. I was confused with Prusha. Purusha and intellect, I guess.
No. Yeah, so you're talking of intellect, not Purusha.
Right, exactly.
Okay, very good. good. So, where are we? Alright, so this is what we said, that the whole Prakriti, the purpose is to have twofold things. One is to provide experience to Purusha, and the other is to eventually understand the distinction and provide liberation to Purusha. That's exactly what is presented in the sutras. Okay? Now, what happens if the Purusha gets liberated? What happens after that? Okay. So, that's what the next sutra says. Let me read the sutra here. So, it says that Kritartham prati nashtam api anashtam tad anya sadharanatvat. It's a long sentence. So this is kritartham prati nashtam api anashtam tadanya sadharanatvat. All right. What does that mean now? Kritartham. Artha means purpose. Krita means done. So when the purpose has been done, when the purpose has been served, all right, that means when the liberation has been attained, that was the purpose, that has been served now. Okay? So once the liberation has happened, then what happens? That it is nashtam. Nashtam means it is finished. It is completely, you can say, destroyed, basically. All right? So what happens is, what it says is that for that Purusha, whose purpose has been served, who has attained liberation, okay, for that Purusha, then this intellect has really very little meaning now. You know, no meaning, essentially, because it is liberated now. It's happy. All right? So now it can live happily ever after, in a sense. No cause for any suffering, no cause for any pain, because that whole complex of ego and intellect which was causing the confusion, that has diminished, that has been eliminated now. All right? So now it can rest very happily in its own true nature. So that's what it is saying. So it's saying that Purusha, once it is liberated, for that Purusha, this Prakriti has no more value now. This Prakriti of this ego and all that. I mean, you can still function in your life, you know, okay? But very cleanly now. So there's absolutely no interaction between the negative ego and the intellect and the memory and all that. For function in life, we need the memory. For function in life, we need the mind. We need all those four functions. Intellect, ego, mind, and the memory. We need all that. What we don't need is the influence of those past impressions called samskaras. So we learn how to use just the pure memory and do not get entangled with the samskaras. And then that's what it's saying, that once the Purusha has been cleansed out, once the Purusha has been liberated, it does not need the help of all this ego and memories and samskaras and all that. It's completely eliminated for that purpose. All right? But what happens is, this Purusha is now liberated, but there are other Purushas which are still struggling, right? Which are still entangled with Prakriti. So Prakriti is not going anywhere. It is still there because it needs to serve the purpose of other Purushas now. That's what the sutra says. It's a very complex, kind of a complicated sutra. Like I said, it's not easy to understand. But the main theme of this Sankhya philosophy is that every living entity is its own individual Purusha. So there is multiplicity of Purushas. Okay? Every entity has its own soul, basically. Every living entity has its own soul. When that soul is liberated, that Prakriti has not much purpose left to do, but that Prakriti is still required to serve the purpose of other Purushas. That's what this statement says. Because other Purushas are still entangled with that Prakriti. Okay? So it's a step-by-step process, one by one, the things get cleaned out. Alright? So all...
Death doesn't necessarily mean you have somehow detached Purusha from Prakriti.
Not at all. Not at all. No.
Okay.
That's the concept that we discussed in the earlier part of this chapter, which talks about reincarnation, death and all that. So what it says in there, now since you brought it up, is that, you know, there's this subtle body, you know, you leave out all the gross elements like the earth, water, fire and all that, but there are the subtle elements, like the subtle five senses and the mind and the ego and the memories and all that. With which all this Purusha is entangled, okay? This Atma is entangled with all that. That whole thing is called the subtle body, or the Jiva, as it's called in Sanskrit, Jiva, J-I-V-A. When a person physically dies, okay, these five elements are disintegrate into the original elements, but the subtle body, it transmigrates. And that is what gets implanted into a new physical body now, along with this Atma which was entangled with it. You get that?
Yes. Yeah. Kind of, I guess.
That's what it is, yeah. That's how they describe transmigration. Okay. So what it's saying is, although destroyed for him who has attained liberation, the prakriti still exists for others. It's because it's common to everything. It's sadharan. Sadharan means it's common with everyone. All right? So that's the sutra here. So basic tenet of yoga and Sankhya is that there is a plurality of purushas and commonality of prakriti. Very important statement. It's important for multiple reasons, you know. The most important reason is that it is different from some of the other philosophical systems. Most importantly, Vedanta. Does anybody know what Vedanta is?
Not exactly, no.
Okay. It doesn't matter.
Is it like just like Vedic knowledge? Or like
no. Vedanta is a... Again, like I said, there are six philosophical systems, and Vedanta is one of them. You know, I listed six philosophical systems in India, and then, you know, Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Sankhya, Yoga, and then there's Vedanta and Mimamsa. Vedanta is that, it is one of the systems where they recognize the reality of only one entity, not more than one. In Sankhya, we have two entities, Purusha and Prakriti, both real, both eternal. In Vedanta, only one entity is real, which is called Brahman, B-R-A-H-M-A-N, Brahman, okay? And this whole complex of this world, you can say, the Jagat as it's called, they say it is temporary. They even use the term Maya.
Yeah.
Maya is the term used for that complex. What did you say?
Mithya.
Mithya, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So there's only one element which is true, which is the Brahman. Everything is, they call it mithya, which is, you can loosely translate it as false or unreal or impermanent. Okay, so that's what they do. So there's always a little bit of a, you can think of it as a tussle between Vedanta and the Sankhya philosophers, you know. They don't like each other for that reason. Okay, so what it says is here, for liberation, prakriti needs to transcend the three gunas. That's important to understand. Sattva, rajas and tamas. Okay, they do a function in life of presenting our experiences in life. But once that function has been done, that has been completed, they need to completely, you know, we need to go back to that, the original complex where we had this prakriti which was totally undisturbed, unmanifest, with the three gunas being totally balanced. So that's the state we want to get into it, okay? So for liberated purusha, there is no entanglement with prakriti. The prakriti, however, continues to provide life experiences for the non-liberated purushas. Okay? This is the most important statement in Sankhya. Both purusha and prakriti are real and eternal. Like I said, it's very different from the Vedanta philosophy. Not the same as Vedanta philosophy, where only Brahman is real and eternal. That's important to recognize. Okay? That's what causes conflict between the philosophers of Sankhya and philosophers of Vedanta.
The question here, Subhashji, I can understand Purusha being eternal, but Prakriti is for a Purusha. So if the Prakriti is not needed once, then it's not, it doesn't exist anymore, isn't it?
It's not needed only for the Purusha which has attained liberation. That was the previous statement. It is still needed for every other Purusha which is still...
That's
Sadharan Latvat, because it is common to every Purusha. Alright. So... Now this is again a very sometimes difficult statement to understand. It took me a long time. Even now, I cannot say that I understand it 100%, but we'll give it a try. So, what it says is, let me read the Sanskrit first. Sva Swami Shaktyoho Swarupa Upalabdhi Hetuhu Samyogaha. Okay. So again, Sva Swami Shaktyoho Swarupa Upalabdhi Hetuhu Samyogaha. Now, Swami, the word Swami means, Swami here. This word Swami means a owner or the Lord, you know, somebody who lords over something. That's Swami. Okay? Swa, the word Swa, S-V-A, it means one who is owned or one who is bossed over, you know, servant, you can say. So if this is the if this is the owner, Swa will represent the servant or one who does job for these. Okay, but then they both have powers, right? They both have Shakti. Shakti means power. And what we Swarupa means their own nature. What it's saying is, the only way, you know, we have already said that in the past, that this union between the two is the cause of suffering. But here it says that union is very essential. So it's a self-contradictory kind of a statement. All right, this is very essential, because unless this union happens, we will have no idea who this Purusha is, who this Prakriti is. We will never have any experience of the life, and this life will be meaningless. So, this Sanyoga, this union between the two, is absolutely essential to understand the powers of each. What is the power of Prakriti? Power of Prakriti is to create. That's the power of Prakriti. It's the creation. It creates this whole human being, it creates this entire universe, and, you know, that's what gives us life experiences, that's what makes us live and all that. That's Prakriti's power. What is Purusha's power? Purusha's power is to provide consciousness to Prakriti, because without that consciousness, Prakriti can do nothing. It is useless. It's inert. Okay? So, these are the two powers that we have to understand. So, these are the word that he has used is Shakti. Shakti. So, this Shaktyoho, that means to understand the respective powers of both Purusha and Prakriti, okay, that necessitates their union. Okay? So their union is essential, and yet that union also causes all the problems in life. So we have to understand. Okay? Once you understand that this union is necessary, then you also have to understand that union is causing problems. Other problems. All right. So the union of owner and the owned, Purusha and Prakriti, causes the recognition of the nature and powers of both of these, Purusha and Prakriti. All right. Purusha is the Swami or the owner, possessor, and Prakriti is the, which is the Swa, or the owned and the possessed. The union between Purusha and Prakriti can bring about both. The same thing, there's a repetition of the Sutra 218 that happens multiple times, okay? So this union between these two can bring about the experience, which is bhoga, and the apavarga. I've not used the word apavarga here, liberation, all right? Oh, this is here, liberation, apavarga. So, bhoga and apavarga, all this is happening in 2.18, okay? So, that's the purpose of Prakriti. But for final liberation, we have to remove the ignorance. The only way to attain liberation is to remove ignorance. What's the ignorance we're talking about? Ignorance about not knowing who I am. Ignorance, not knowing that I'm actually separate from this Prakriti, I'm there just as an observer, but I'm ignorant about it, so I'm letting myself be entangled with Prakriti, and I'm letting myself get into all kinds of mess. So that's the way to look at it. Okay? But when you attain that state of liberation, so what the statement here is that for liberation caused by removal of ignorance, final liberation, it breaks that bond between Purusha and Prakriti. Then that leads to the state of, Patanjali calls it the state of Kaivalya. That's the final state of liberation. And the Sanskrit word Patanjali uses is Kaivalya. Okay? But this union itself, like we have said, is caused by ignorance. Okay, this ignorance is beginningless, they say. It has no beginning. It came with the origin of the universe. We were born with that avidya. We were born with that ignorance. Okay? This is just a repetition of the same thing. Tasya hetur avidya. The cause of this union is ignorance. Okay? I'm repeating the same thing from the previous sutra. So this is a repetition of what we have said here. Okay? But just let's just read through this anyway. Avidya is the cause of the union between Purusha and Prakriti. Avidya is beginningless. Why is it beginningless? Okay, now this, you may have to have a slight digression here, because in the Indian Hindu philosophy, there is this concept called pralaya. Does anybody know, has heard the term pralaya? P-R-A-L-A-Y. Anybody know what pralaya is?
Yeah.
What is it? Go ahead.
It is when all the atmas get resolved and go into unresolved state, and then they come back.
Okay. So, the whole concept in this creation is that we go through cycles of creation and dissolution. Now, each cycle may last millions of years, okay? Millions of years. It doesn't. It's not something that happens overnight. It lasts millions of years. And there are periods mentioned, in ancient texts, how long exactly that cycle is, okay? But we are apparently going through these cycles of dissolution and reappearance, all right? And this happens periodically. How periodically? Like I said, millions of years apart. Okay? So it probably won't happen in our lifetime. Hopefully not. Now, what happens is, remember there are multitudes of purushas which are hanging around, entangled with their prakriti, and they're all messed up, right? And in their subtle body form, they are completely indistinguishable from prakriti, basically, from the ego or from the intellect. Now, what happens is that at the time of this pralaya or dissolution, everything goes back to the source, as they say. Everything goes back to the source. There's no creation at that point. There's no life at that point. And these purushas and their entangled jivas, as they call jiva, they get merged back to the source. But, who keeps record? it's hard to understand. Who keeps all this record? But there's a record kept, okay, that this purusha is entangled because of these samskaras. Okay, this purusha is entangled because of these samskaras. Okay, so this record is kept by somebody. I don't know who does it. So, and this whole sleep cycle, as they call it, it's a fairly long sleep cycle. Okay, but then
Subhash?
Yes.
Yeah, so there is an explanation for this, actually.
Uh-huh.
I'm coming from Tamil thing, so take it for what is worth.
Uh-huh.
So this is the very simple explanation in the whole thing, right? So for every human being who is born, what is the ultimate goal is to find out the self-consciousness.
Uh-huh.
All right, so at the end of the day, everything is else is nothing. So you have to find who you are, who am I. So if you ask the question,
and the self-consciousness you need to find out. But you have all other things that is affecting you to get into that. So when you show that map, it's basically it. So what it is all the senses, all the things it's affecting to go into that. So when you explain to that, when the moon is reflecting on the water and you have the disturbances, those are the disturbances.
Mm-hmm.
So when you stop the disturbances, you see that moon, and that is you, which is inside you. And mm-hmm. if you can get into that, that's basically the ultimate goal of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the yoga is the one path of getting into that thing. So, and you know that in Advaita says that there is only three stages in a human being: walking state, a sleeping state, or a dream state, and a deep sleep, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're walking, you're aware of it. You know who you are. You're walking, and you know what is outside. You don't see the wall. But when you go to a dream stage, you see yourself in the dream. So you question yourself, you know, I know my body is already, you know, sleeping state. My body's not moving. It's all the senses are all gone, but still you see it.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're seeing is there is a third party seeing that dream, and that's if that you are walking and you are talking to somebody, you are going here and there. So that is what the sleeping stage is. And the deep sleep state is when you sleep in the morning and you wake up and you say, you know what, I don't really know what happened between 2 to 4.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing happens. There is no self-consciousness, there is nothing. And that is called the deep sleep state. And mm-hmm. all they say is in the Tamil Vela is, your goal is to get into that self-consciousness. And you can literally, with this body, you can get there. And that's what the yogis did.
Right.
And these are the paths to get into that mode of doing that.
Right.
And if you read about Ramanas and everything, that's Ramakrishna, that's what they are getting into that path.
Absolutely.
And there are different paths of getting into that. That's 64 different paths of getting, the Tamil says, of getting how you can get into that.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Yeah, thanks for that summary of the whole thing. Basically, exactly this is what we have been discussing.
Yeah, well, and also this cycle, why the cycle happens is because of the karma, he says. Right?
Yes, yes.
There are three things in karma. One is the one you collected, what you have collected in previous life. And the second is this, what you accumulate in this life, and what is given to you. And if you want to break the cycle, and that is what the pain is, if you don't really want to have a death, so the question is you really don't want to be born, right? So if there is a birth, there is always a death.
Right.
And if you really don't want a death, then you don't want to be pain and sufferings, don't get into that mode. You don't really want a birth. So
right.
What can I do to don't have a birth, don't have any karma? So how do I get into the not having a karma is you don't have any accumulation. Each action has a equal and opposite reaction. It's the same thing. So whatever you collect the good deeds in this life, and whatever the bird deeds you collect in this life, that will be reciprocated in the next life. That is what we call karma. So don't collect anything. Then there is no way of coming into that cycle.
Right. Very good.
That's what the yogis did. So if you go and see the yogis and everything, they don't have any attachment, nothing, because they don't have any of these things. And that's how they broke the cycle of birth and rebirth and death and birth.
Right.
That's all.
Very good. Yeah. Thank you. Excellent. It's a good, great summary, you know. Exactly what but I was extending it to this whole cycle of dissolution, which is beyond this cycle of birth and rebirth, okay? And this is a part of the Hindu-Indian philosophy, that there comes a time after, you know, multiple years, millions of years, that the entire thing gets dissolved back into its own source. But then there's this concept where it says that, you know, my karma is attached with this purusha. Okay, so this purusha has this karma attached to it, this purusha has this karma attached to it, and there's a separate assessment, and then the record left for all that. When the rebirth happens, when all this whole recreation starts, then they again go back to the same state. Okay, so the same purusha will be attached to its own karma or its own samskara. Samskara is the same thing as karma, basically. Okay. But that's what is the connection between the two. Okay, but that's how they say that that this, because this concept of karma and then the samskaras is all attached to the purusha because of what? Because of avidya, because of ignorance. That is why they say this avidya, this ignorance, is beginningless, because it started from the day we were brought into this whole creation. Okay, the very first day of creation, we already had that attachment to our of ego, and that's why we had avidya. So they say avidya is beginningless, but it is not endless. Sometimes they say what is beginningless is also endless, not avidya, not ignorance, because once the avidya is destroyed, that's when we get liberated. Okay? So this is the whole thing it states here, that avidya's ignorance is beginningless. As part of this subtle body, it goes through cosmic cycles of dissolution and recreation. So this is, the word he uses is cosmic cycles. That's the big cycle. Not this individual life and death, rebirth and all. This is cosmic cycle. And then because of this avidya, purusha is identified with the subtle body. And this bondage leads to cycle of death and rebirth. This is the normal birth and rebirth. But liberation is attained when avidya is dispelled. Okay? Now what causes avidya to go away? Knowledge, true knowledge. Okay? So what Vyasa, the commentator, says here, that look, we say knowledge will destroy everything. Knowledge is not the one which causes liberation. It's not knowledge. Knowledge causes the elimination of avidya. It's the avidya, it's the ignorance that we need to destroy to attain liberation. So they make a distinction between these two statements, the commentators. They say, we need to eliminate avidya, ignorance. Then only we will be liberated. But what do we need to eliminate avidya? Is knowledge. Okay? So knowledge is an indirect cause of liberation. That's how they want to us to understand that.
Subhash, I have a question about liberation. You mentioned, I think in the previous slide, that both Purusha and Prakriti are perpetual or endless.
They're eternal, yeah.
Eternal, yeah. So after liberation, the Purusha is liberated, but it still exists, right?
Yeah, they're still there, but they have no role to play in life now.
So you break the cycle of birth and death and rebirth, so you don't have to come back to this earth.
Right, that's the idea.
The Purusha still exists somewhere.
Somewhere, I don't know what happens to that, you know. Those things are not explained in the Sankhya philosophy.
Yeah.
They say it's a part of nature. You become part of nature.
I have one more question, too. You mentioned the six philosophical schools of Indian thought. Can you comment on how that relates to Hinduism? Are they all considered part of Hindu thought?
Well, let's not call it Hindu thought. Let's call it the Vedic thought.
Yes.
Okay, because you know, these Vedas, you know, the four Vedas, they are the most ancient, you know, you can say collection of knowledge, wisdom, okay? Okay, so what happens is, you know, these Vedas are, I mean, they are given the term apaurusheya or shruti, which literally means that they are not a creation of the human mind, not the creation of human intellect. How were they created? They were revealed to these yogis in their deepest state of meditation. So they were revelations rather than creation. Okay, that's how they kind of describe these. All right, but then you know whatever was revealed to them, then they created all these other rituals and procedures and mantras and all that came out as a result of all that happening. And then all these Upanishads came up as a result of this understanding, and then the philosophical essence was collected in the Upanishads. So the ritualistic part was left in the Vedas, and the Upanishads came up as the essence or the true philosophical content understanding of what the reality is in the Upanishads. So these six wise people, you can call them, okay, they took elements from this wisdom that was a part of this Vedic wisdom, and they evolved six different philosophical systems. The goal is still the same. The goal is still the same of attaining realization, self-realization, basically, in all these six systems. But they took different approaches to describe what goes on in the mind, or to describe the whole process. So the goal is the same, but six different philosophers, you can call them wise people, rishis, they were, you know, very obviously extremely bright people, and they took these elements from these Upanishads and the Vedic thought, and they built these individual streams of philosophy, you can call them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that helps. So you think these six all sort of split around the same time, or was...
I think from what I understand, Sankhya is the oldest of these all.
Oldest, yeah.
Okay, and then... You know, even though there are major differences in some of them, but there are pockets, you can say, the elements from Sankhya which are in every philosophy, like the gunas and all that. The gunas are a part of every philosophy. They borrowed it from Sankhya, right? And there are many other concepts in Sankhya which are part of Vedanta, part of Yoga, Nyaya, and all that. Okay, so, but then there are differences also. Okay, so, let me see, where are we? So, liberation is attained when avidya is dispelled through discriminatory wisdom, all right? So, that's where we are. So, let's stop here, it's 4:20. So, I'm going to say that we finished 2:24. All right, we'll start with the 2:25 next time, next month. And, okay, so let me stop the share here.